welcome to another episode of We the People Radio. My name is Aaron Ryan.
And my name is Bill Cundiff.
And today we're going to chat about climate again.
I'm very concerned about it because it's almost 100 degrees outside and things are warming up.
Well, the second hour we're going to talk about July of 2026 not being the hottest month on record, so I thought that was fairly fitting last week as we were all telling each other, gosh, isn't it great? It's not as hot as it usually is. I was like, yeah, these guys, man, they never end.
Yeah, August is usually our hottest month, has the most hot days and the hottest days.
And the hottest nights. I mean, just never goes below 95. Never leave your window open. And
we've been in the 60s.
It's just silly. Yeah. It has been silly, and now it has not been silly.
No.
So our guest this first hour, I can't believe we haven't talked to her in so long. I could have sworn we just chatted with her, and then I went back through the archives. I think it's been like 2 years. So we're idiots, and I apologize. Dr. Judith Curry is the president and co-founder of Climate Forecast Applications Network, CFAN. She is professor emerita at the Georgia Institute of Technology, where she served as chair of Earth and Atmospheric Sciences for 13 years. Her expertise is climate dynamics, extreme weather, and prediction and predictability. She is a fellow of the American Meteorological Society, the American Association for the Advancement of Science, actual real science, and the American Geophysical Union. And the first time we interviewed her, she had relatively recently been canceled.
Yep, she got canceled.
That climate change is the greatest challenge facing humanity in the 21st century. And she piped up and said, beg to differ.
Hold your horses.
But what caught me the other day and what kind of got us on this, I was on the LinkedIn website and I saw her name and I was like, oh, I love her. Clicked on it. It said, what can the U.S. learn from China's energy policy? A good deal, including don't break it before you fix it, according to climate scientist Judith Curry. And I totally laughed. I'm like, don't break it before you fix it. That's totally perfect. We have to have her come on in and cancel herself some more. Please come on and cancel yourself with us. So, Dr. Curry, what spurred that that on? It said it was on What and Why with Mike Smith. I don't know what that is, but
I think it's a relatively old
podcast.
Yeah,
it was 8 months old, but I thought that's like perfect because that is, and that's what we're doing with our fuel in California. And it was part of a kind of a thread there, that same idea that here we're closing all our refineries, we have no substitute, we don't have any other way to get fuel, but hey, who cares? Let's drive off the cliff anyway.
It's got to be done.
Well, and then shutting down nuclear power plants.
Yes.
And decommissioning coal plants. I mean, it's not such a big issue in California, the coal plants, but when you get these crazy, crazy cold outbreaks, out in the east, you know, they use the coals as peak burners, you know, because you can store the fuel and you can fire them up and you can provide the electricity and heating that you need. And by shutting those down, you know, they're caught really short when they have huge demand in very cold weather. So, I mean, it makes no sense. By all means, go in and develop, you know, new power sources, new power stations, but don't take down the old ones until you can cover it with the new stuff.
Right.
I mean, that's just common sense.
Doesn't that just seem like common sense? But we, and so the pushback for that seems to always be, but we have to do it. I mean, that's like the answer, which is
a terrible answer. I think Texas learned that lesson here a couple of years ago when they had big freeze and they were depending on wind power and they all froze.
Well, no, that was a more complicated, the Texas one is a more complicated situation. They have incorporated a lot of renewables, but, you know, they keep, you know, they have some nuclear and still a lot of gas power. But the problem that they ran into was the problem was really there was no renewables, and then the gas power The lines were frozen, and they couldn't really get the natural gas. So that was a relatively, but they didn't have, you know, a sort of a fail-safe margin. You know, everything had to work, and
right.
when certain things didn't work, they didn't have any backup. So the Texas one was a little bit more complicated. But, it's, I think it's the places who've shut down their nuclear power plant, like New York, all of a sudden realizing how stupid that was. I sat on a committee for the New York Electricity Reliability Corp. I guess the engineers were told to figure out, well, how do we make power driven by wind and solar work with a little bit of hydropower that we can import from Canada? You know, and, you know, we looked at, you know, extreme weather events and what happens, you know, when the wind doesn't blow, basically, and that can happen for, you know, days at a time. And, you know, that there's just no way that you can support the state of New York on wind and solar.
Yeah.
And so they finally realized it, and now Kathy Hochul, their governor, is trying to, okay, we need nuclear power. You know, we need lots of nuclear power, you know, when they could have been doing this for the last 20 years rather than investing all that money in wind and solar, realizing it doesn't work, then having to resuscitate the nuclear power plants that they shut down and start the process for new nuclear power plants. I mean, it's just insanity. People, not California necessarily, but most of the states are realizing that they can't rely on wind and solar, and that they need nuclear and gas. Coal is still unpopular, but except for in like Montana and Wyoming and states like that where they have a lot of coal resources, and it's so easy to store in the really cold temperatures.
Sure.
Where natural gas starts to be problematic. So, I mean, it's a complex, you know, the electric power grid in the U.S. is insanely complex. And then thinking that they could, you know, reinvent the whole thing on the time scale of a few decades with a vastly inferior power source was just insanity. And, you know, this people, you know, I don't know, sort of a tulip mania type situation over the urgency of the CO2 emissions problem. You know, people were just sort of crazy over that issue. We have to do it. No, we don't have to do it. You know, people are realizing it doesn't make sense. And, you know, we'll eventually transition away from fossil fuels. But not on the time scale of 10 to 20 years. So we just need to stop panicking over that and stop causing more problems than we're solving.
Yeah, I guess that's always my thing, is it always has to be a panic. And there's always all this pressure. You have to do it right now or else. And as soon as they start that, I guess I'm always suspicious. What is
well,
up there?
AOC said we only had 12 years, and that was, what, 10 years ago?
Well, yeah, and then they're always wrong about that.
Yeah.
So you're cancel, you know, your big canceling situation from before, since we haven't spoken with you in a while, are you still in the doghouse, as it were?
Oh, no. My cancellation really started more than a decade ago, so it's not a recent thing. So,
okay.
You know, so the whole cancel Judith Curry, you know, is sort of old news. I guess with the Trump administration, there's been people who have been marginalized were, you know, sort of brought into the fold, if you will. I don't know if I've spoken with you since the about a year ago, the U.S. Department of Energy issued a critique of the climate assessment report, and I was one of the co-authors on that, and that stirred up a big hornet's nest amongst the true believers. But, you know, I think it it sparked a change, you know, in how we talk about this issue. I mean, since then, you know, like the urgency has declined. We no longer see every extreme weather event being blamed on fossil fueled warming and things like that. And overall, the media pays this whole issue a lot less attention. I mean, it used to be major media outlets, you know, had a 50-person climate desk. And now they've, like, shut those down. Yeah. And, you know, climate change just isn't in the news as much. And I even saw some statistics on the number of papers being published with the word, scientific papers being published with the word climate change in them, and there's been a precipitous drop over the past 2 years. Not just a funding issue, but people are, you know, just not feeling obligated to frame everything, all of their scientific research, in context of climate change.
A situation of crying wolf for the last 15 years, and now people are starting to think, you know what, we've been hearing this for a long time, and we're still here.
Right, exactly. People have, I mean, even like Greta Thunberg has moved on. You know, mm-hmm. She's off.
Exactly.
So people have just moved on. A lot of the NGOs have collapsed for a number of reasons. I would say the soft money for all this has dried up. The World Economic Forum, they're not talking about climate change anymore. They're focused on AI issues, which makes a whole lot more sense for them to focus on. So it's just laws, you know. And I think Trump's election sort of gave a kick in the pants, you know, to this issue. But I think it was bigger than that. I think there was, everyone was just ready to be, you know, to move past this in a sensible way and just stop focusing on this issue that just isn't worth all the attention it's been given.
Right.
Well, because none of their stuff really happened.
No, I mean, well, we're talking decades, but the alarm has been sounded for several decades now, you know, since the 90s. So this is, you know, 3 decades, really. Mm-hmm. We haven't really seen anything bad happen. You know, agricultural productivity is way up. Population growth is way up. Economies are, you know, thriving for the most part. I mean, even deaths from extreme weather events are down considerably. The planet is greening, you know, from all the carbon dioxide in the atmosphere.
Because CO2 makes plants grow, huh? Mm-hmm.
Sure. So
the one thing that is getting a lot of play right now is the El Nino, and if you read about that, and I mean, now they're saying, oh, this could be a super El Nino. So, I mean, it's almost like fear porn. You know, they just want everybody to panic about something that hasn't happened.
Yeah. Well, okay. Now, the El Nino is a much more interesting one than the whole slow-creeping global warming. You know, within a few months, maybe, you know, certainly by February, we'll know how this played out. It's already a very strong El Nino. Whether it reaches, you know, the strength of the mega El Nino in 1877, or even reaches like as bad as what we saw in 1997 or 2015. I mean, it could. We don't know yet. But a couple of things. You know, the El Nino took off like a rocket, you know, in June and July, and it was coming from a La Nina, you know, a cold situation. Mm-hmm. So it had a lot of ground to make up. And it took off like a rocket in June and July. Now it started to slow down, and there's a couple of things that haven't really materialized that, to my mind, would be needed to support this, to make it, you know, a crazy extreme event. Like the Indian Ocean isn't playing out how you would expect. you know, if it's going to be a super El Nino, and the whole Pacific is warm, the North Pacific is warm, and that is a pattern that doesn't really support big development of the El Nino. It's usually colder to the north. So, and the sub-seasonal variability, the so-called Mann-Julian oscillation, that seems to be slowing down. It was really kicking up a lot in May, June, and July. So, you know, I think it's going to slow down a little bit. It's still going to be a really strong one, a major event. Right now, I'm not seeing some crazy record-breaking event. But this is natural climate variability.
Exactly, yeah.
You know?
I mean, it's happened before, and you know what? Maybe some people died, but you know, humanity didn't get washed away in the last couple of El Ninos, so I think they exaggerate. I mean,
it's always the big hysteria. We have to take a really quick break, and when we come back, though, I want to make sure that we don't skip over, because one of the other things that I was reading about in here was the AI part. So when you mentioned that AI, post that involved you, said AI is generating hype in hurricane forecasting, and it's like, oh, that too. So not only is it butting into your life and overtaking your email and writing resumes and, I don't know, is it telling people what to wear yet? I think it's telling them what to eat, but I don't know. Now apparently it's butting in on hurricanes. When we come back with our guest, Dr. Judith Curry, you are listening to We the People. You can find us at wethepeopleradio.us. Originally thinking with that song that it was kind of, it's magic that everything is about climate change and stuff and how the narrative always goes that way. But then Alex, our engineer, reminded us that we have the magic of the Wayback Machine. And in the 90s, Chris Farley, the comedian on Saturday Night Live, did a thing about the El Nino and said,
I am El Nino. All other tropical storms must bow before El Nino. Yo soy El Nino. For those of you who don't habla español, El Nino is Spanish for the Nino.
That was our climate education in the 90s. Oh my God! So, okay. So, what's the situation here with AI is now trying to steal your job of predicting real weather, and now it's hyping hurricane forecasting?
No.
Do people care about that? I mean, do they believe that?
Okay. AI. About 3 years ago, AI started making a big splash in the weather forecasting world. AI, you know, global AI models, some of which have been tuned to predict hurricanes and things like that. Some of them are very good. You have to, you know, interpret them appropriately and evaluate them and this,
sure,
that, and the other. There are some crummy AI models out there, but, you know, the AI models have been a net positive for weather forecasting.
Oh.
But there are all sorts of idiots out there who hype you know, single scenarios from a bad model, and, you know, so there's all sorts of people trying to play on AI fear and all that kind of stuff, spouting a bunch of nonsense. But on balance, it's a net positive. It's not replacing conventional weather forecast models or weather forecasters or anything like that. But it's a new toolbox, and, you know, like my company, Climate Forecast Application Networks, we're using some of the global AI models, but we've also developed our own, you know, AI-based forecast system for severe convective weather, you know, tornadoes and hail stuff that's AI-based. So, you know, AI is good news for weather forecasting, but that doesn't mean that everything that all AI models are good, or all people spouting off on X or wherever know what they're talking about.
Well, that's good to know, because I don't know, give us an example, kind of just an idea of where you have to have the human interpretation. Like, what are the things that the models, I would assume there's a pattern, maybe, that they traditionally get things wrong?
It's
kind of a weird question.
There's a bunch of different models,
mm-hmm.
Okay, and there's no particular reason to believe a single one of them all the time. Sometimes model A gets it right, but other times model A gets it wrong and model B gets it right. So
yeah.
It's trying to interpret under which conditions the models might be doing it. It's trying to evaluate the larger scale situation. For example, all of the models are, for the last couple of weeks, have been hyperactive at trying to form a hurricane or a tropical storm in the tropical East Atlantic, okay? And the storms, you know, the models say high probability, but the waves just fizzle, and it hasn't happened yet. Everyone's watching a new one and giving it about 50% chance. I still think the whole situation still may be too hostile for these predictions to actually pan out. So that's an example of where, you know, the human element comes in, you know, to give a realistic chance of whether this is going to form or not. And also, in evaluating how various forecast models are doing under which conditions and at which time horizon, and adding value to the forecast, you know, with modules like landfall impacts or whatever. So there's lots of work for the humans to do, but without the models, you know, we'd be so really hampered.
Yeah, that makes sense. So it's kind of like a lot of things. It's a useful tool, but it isn't a replacement.
Yeah, it's a tool. Yeah, exactly.
So if we look at your and I realize it was a year ago, but I don't know how many people paid attention to that. The report that came out through the Department of Energy. What did that change, or what did that was it basically a reframing or a reorientation of our policy?
No, it was a critique. It was a critique of the science. It really wasn't a policy recommendation or anything like that. It was just a critique of the science and laid out where the uncertainties are. We pointed out that the extreme emission scenarios that give all the alarming warming, those are unrealistic, and they're just not panning out. So we should, you know, completely dismiss all the climate model simulations that are using these extreme emission scenarios. And everybody now widely accepts that. People have been saying it before us. Now we emphasized it, and now even, you know, the UN and everybody else are not using these extreme emission scenarios anymore. You know, I think we made a strong case that extreme weather events in the U.S. for the most part, were worse in the first half of the 20th century than they are now.
Yeah.
So it's not, things aren't worsening. And I think that may be the most significant impact of the DOE report, because since then, seen a lot less of the media attributing every extreme weather event to fossil fuels warming. So, we've seen that quiet down. A more realistic perspective on sea level rise, a more realistic assessment on, have there really been any economic losses that can be attributed to fossil fuels warming? Well, not really. Things like that. So it was just like put a lot of things in a more realistic context. And I think it's, in many ways, has carried the day. That's not to say that all the climate alarmists weren't hysterical after this report was published.
Oh, God, I bet they were hysterical.
Oh, yeah, and attacked us like crazy, and they organized this group of 85 scientists to write a, I don't know how many, 700-page critique of our report. I mean, the whole report was only like 150 pages with references. And we've responded to all that and, a few useful suggestions, but none of the significant, criticisms really landed. So the bottom line is you don't hear people talking about this issue so much anymore. Although in California, California is its own planet. Yeah, its own planet of, craziness.
Madness, yes.
Yeah, but everywhere else it's calmed down quite a bit.
Well, see, that, and that's really nice, because we are hamstringing business and productivity and cost of living and all of these things still based on all of that. So the world moved on and California stayed kind of in the rut that they love, which is that why we're getting rid of tires? Some kinds of tires.
Oh, they're putting some sort of.
There's like a moratorium on the kind of tires we can have. Black market tire purchase.
They have to have an energy rating now. How much are they going to save you?
How do you do that?
I don't know.
Yeah. So we'll have to go out of state to buy tires and sneak them across the border. We'll get fined for bringing in tires from elsewhere. It's like...
Oh, I hadn't heard that one.
Oh, God. Yeah, they just did that I think it was last week.
Yeah.
So trucks and all these, people who run heavy equipment and things, they can't have these, just sad little Fisher-Price tires that you can run on a Prius. You need to have big... giant,
So spend $800 to save $49.
Right. Yeah, so that'll cost everybody and accomplish nothing. So, yeah, we're not moving on here. So, if you ever decide you want to play both sides of the fence, you could come here and try out some antiquated climate alarmism and see if it still resonates, because I'm pretty sure it will.
A lot of things in California are in such great shape, I have to say.
Yeah.
We can. Over here in Nevada, things are a little bit safer, but we do have a big fire that's not all that far away. Big fire burning in Reno.
That is still. I guess I was following it, and then I didn't. Didn't get onto my watch duty here. Is it still kind of out of control, or?
Yeah, it's kind of out of control. It's on a like Mount Peavine. It's on like a sort of a big hill, but it's surrounded on three sides by the residential areas, and it's not all that far from the Reno campus of University of Nevada.
Right.
So. So it's a little bit of a scary location. And we still have winds. I mean, it's when you get really big winds, they can't really contain it. So I haven't seen much I live in the south end of town, so I'm sort of away from all that, but I can see the smoke. Yeah, so it's scary.
Yeah, because you're at 10, the Hawk Fire, because I was thinking it was Bug Fire.
Yeah, that's the Hawk Fire.
Yeah, yeah, and the Bug Fire was kind of handled, and I'm like, wait a minute, the Hawk Fire, that's at 10,000 acres.
Okay, yeah, the Bug Fire, we had rain 2 days later, so that put everything out. But
yeah,
there's no rain in sight right now, so this is the Hawk Fire. That's a scary one. So hopefully this will get under control. But the last big fire year we had, I think, was 2019, and I lived in a different part of town, but there were two fires within a half a mile of my house, and then a third one about 5 miles away, and it was very, very scary. Yeah, well, California is no stranger to fires, but it's,
no, but yeah, we won't even talk about. It's kind of been not. I mean, Oregon and Nevada have been really hammered this year. But I'm looking at, you know, some of the big helicopters that are running on your fire right now. So you've got a lot of air resources at the moment.
Yep.
Which is good.
Yep.
And so for those people who look at that kind of stuff and see the zero containment's actually kind of good, because zero containment means they won't pull any resources from the fire. Doesn't necessarily mean that there is zero containment. It just means they don't have to admit it yet, which means they don't have to give up the air resources. So sometimes that's a good thing. People go by the containment and they think, oh, they're not getting anywhere on it. And it's like, well, they are, but... as soon as they start showing containment, then those resources get repurposed. And
If it's moving, if it's moving west, and you know, it's not bad, but it's the other direction. So if it is, it may be expanding in a favorable direction as long as they can contain it. You know, in the directions where property's vulnerable.
Yeah, because it's right up against all the homes there.
Right. Scary situation.
Okay, we'll pay more attention. I was following the other one, and didn't realize yesterday this one popped up. My bad.
Yeah.
And you're right on the other side from us. So with all of this stuff happening, how tightly are you following the gas, the whole gas thing?
Which gas thing?
Well, the fuels that, I mean, you know, your fuel comes from California, and with the shutdown of all the refineries and stuff, you're looking at I don't know, what are you, 88% of your fuel comes from here?
I didn't know that.
Yeah. Yeah, so, you know, for people looking to, we're fixing to take you with us, as they say. We're gonna ruin Phoenix too while we're at it. We're gonna take them with us. They're 40%, I think, of their fuel comes from here. But
oh my goodness, I didn't even know that.
Yeah, 6 of the 7 refineries that remain in California have given notice that if California Air Resources Board back to you again, right? Because of all their insane climate religion, if they don't make a change in their policy, PBF, Marathon, and Chevron will take two refineries each and go someplace else. And if they do that, you know, we're kind of looking at Thunderdome. And for those people who didn't ever watch Mad Max and Thunderdome, you should really go back and watch that.
It's
instructive. What I remember vividly is the person with the midget is in charge. So,
two men enter, one man leaves.
Oh yeah, that's right, the Thunderdome. And so it's, but it is pretty spooky because there is no workaround for that. We've been doing a bunch of shows on that. So for people who are going, what?
Oh wow.
Go to gascrisis.org. Somebody has the .com. I don't even know what it is, but I made it go to our website, and we listed a ton of information. We've been doing a lot of shows.
Oh, okay. I'll go there.
Yeah.
Because
the Jones Act
right.
allowed... There was a suspension of that, which has helped. So the only reason that we're not completely down the drain is because the Jones Act was suspended, and there were a few other things You know, they greenlit some drilling, but that's nice. You can drill all the oil you want, but if you can't refine it, it's not worth anything. So
yeah.
there's quite a bit happening, and we're looking to ruin your world too. So here we are lashed to the same mast in the middle of the storm. Not great. Huh. Well, it wasn't supposed to go this direction, but you know what? It always goes back to fuel for me, because I look at that, and Professor Michael Miché, I think, really kind of summed it up, and he said, you know, yes, petroleum products are part of the economy, but what people fail to recognize is it's the first 8% of the economy, and without that, you don't have the other 92. You have to have,
right.
You got to have the base to get things done and make things happen. So anyway, we'll take a quick break on that. I think Alex has some science songs for us. Then we're going to come back with our guest, Dr. Judith Curry, and we're going to explore more about how you can take a breather from climate change. Oh, how nice.
Yeah.
You're listening to We the People. You can find us at wethepeopleradio.us. Bill's just showing me the robot Olympics. I got to tell you, they all get to the end and then they crash because they don't know how to stop, I guess. Once you turn them on, they don't stop. So apparently we're not going to replace real Olympics with robot Olympics just yet. They all had to be taken out on little robot stretchers.
It's very entertaining, though.
It is kind of entertaining, I got to say. Yeah. Oh, my gosh. So, Dr. Curry, back to tell us more about CFAN. Go more into what you do there, if you would.
Okay. We're a weather and climate services company. We don't do, like, weather or climate, you know, just for, like AccuWeather or whatever for public consumptions. We're more of a, most of our clients are other businesses and in some instances government agencies. We predict extreme weather events at longer time horizons and greater accuracy than our competitors, which is sort of our main claim to fame and source of revenue. We also do climate impact assessments. For instance, I just was asked to submit a proposal to a group, an organization, well, it's actually a government-funded agency in the Middle East, who wants a more realistic climate assessment. You know, they're told, oh, you know, the whole region's going to be inhabitable, you know, by 2050. No, that's not what they want to hear. You know, they know that's not the case.
Mm-hmm.
And sea level rise is going to drown them. Well, they're not seeing that happening. You know, they have good engineers. They can figure it out, but they need some sort of realistic assessment of just what's going on and where this is headed over the next couple of decades. So there's a real hunger, you know, governments and businesses who need to make decisions about investments, about infrastructure and whatever, and they're fed all this crazy alarmism. know, all they can do is, you know, shrug their shoulders in the face of that. It's too much, and it's not credible. So how are they supposed to respond to it? Like, okay, sea level rise in the U.S.
Oh, I love that one.
I know, and you know, and it's really a slow creep. You know, in most places, you know, it's gone up by like 8 or 9 inches in 100 years, and a significant part of that is because the land is sinking, not just because the sea level is rising. And you know, people like in Miami and the Florida Keys and place where the really low lying, and they're told, well, it's going to be 5 feet by 21, you know, 5 or 6 feet by 2100. They say, well, we can accommodate 2 feet, but you know, 6 feet,
yeah, right.
Place is underwater. So you know, what are they supposed to do? You know, give them more realistic projections and point them in the directions of strategies that other people, other countries have used, dynamic adaptation pathways, you know, to try to set yourself up to be able to manage however this turns out to evolve. You know, you don't want to invest too much up front, but you want to be positioned if things, you know, get worse as time goes on, that you can deal with it. So, you know, trying to establish, you know, a sensible basis. Now, this one is publicly known because in New Jersey, okay, this is a good one. So I wrote a report for the New Jersey Business and Industry Association, and I did publish this one. Okay, what they had been fed, and this is, I'm going to say, back in 2018 or so, they had all the fancy grand poobahs from the universities in New Jersey put, you know, do a sea level rise assessment. And the policymakers were interested in, they wanted to know the upper end of the likely range for the medium emission scenario. Okay, and so the New Jersey grand poobahs of sea level rise told them it was 5.25 feet. By 2100. Okay, and so they're going to shut down the Jersey Shore and all this kind of stuff. They're ready to start doing this, you know.
Oh, jeez.
And so the New Jersey Business and Industry Association said, if we do that, this might not be right. And so they asked me to take a look at this and give my own assessment. And it turned out those people made a really stupid mistake, okay, in their calculation, and they exaggerated other things and this, that, and the other. And so I wrote this report and documented and made the arguments. And this has been going on, you know, for half a dozen years. You know, we've been fighting for this higher level of sea level rise, and then the New Jersey Business and Industry Association, though, that makes no sense. And finally, they've come back with a more modest, you know, these so-called experts, a more modest sea level rise projection, which was a little bit higher than my original one, but you know, it was relatively reasonable. And, you know, I'm giving this whole hand-wavy thing why their previous, well, we didn't really give you the medium emission scenario. We gave you the medium high emission scenario, and we incorporated too much of an impact from instability of the Antarctic sea ice, you know, and these are things that I pointed out, you know, back at my 2019 report, and this is still badly on. Apparently, the new governor, Mikey Sherrill, new governor of New Jersey, is relatively sane on the issue. She's a, you know, not so sane on some other things, but she's willing to consider, you know, lower values of sea level rise in their planning. But, you know, back in 2018, they were ready to just close down the Jersey Shore based on these model projections.
Wow.
And, you know, it's just like, you know, real people and communities and states, you know, are having to make decisions. And then, okay, so a California story. Sea level rise is a problem in parts of California, mainly San Francisco, like the airport. That's because they did all this landfill and then built the airport on top of the landfill and it's sinking.
Hmm.
Okay, so they're blaming the fossil fuel companies, and they're suing them, you know, trying to get money for, you know, so the state can do what, I don't know what, but, you know, suing Chevron and all of the companies. And
oh, yeah.
All of the lawsuits are mired in procedural things. Should it be heard in the state courts or federal courts or, you know, and all sorts of legal shenanigans going on for 10 years now. But these lawsuits are still out there. Trying to blame the oil companies for sea level rise, and most of the time it's human caused issues, where like the San Francisco airport is an egregious example. You know, they did the landfill, did an airport on top of it, you know.
Like, yeah.
What did you think was going to happen?
No climate change needed, right?
Yeah, right. So, you know, that's an example of some of the things that, you know, my company grapples with. For clients who just want a more realistic assessment of the climate issues. But then the weather issues, we're very much mired in the hurricane forecasting. That's a big part of what we do, mostly for insurance companies, but also for electric utilities. Yeah, electric utilities also. I happen to have one client in California. It's a lot of fun, and I like being, you know, doing stuff that helps, you know, real people, real companies, you know, make real decisions rather than just trying to so panic about, you know, non-existent risks, such as, you know, the alarm over, you know, 5 foot sea level rise by 2100 kind of thing.
Well, I thought it was also interesting on your site that it says climate science is becoming increasingly important in policymaking and litigation. And when the growing policy emphasis upon adaptation to climate change and attribution of causes of extreme weather and climate events, the potential for disputes is multiplying. So you guys provide expert testimony and litigation support, and I thought, well, that's pretty
neat. Yeah.
That's very handy to get somebody who's factual.
Right. Well, yeah, internationally, I supported, it was a big case in the Netherlands that they were suing Royal Dutch Shell, and I provided some expert testimony that was actually accepted into the, whatever it is, the appeals process and the final decision. And fortunately, they found in favor of Shell, where, you know, they just really couldn't blame them for the problems that the Netherlands was having. And there was a big one in Montana. Most of the time, these things get thrown out or get tied up in all sorts of procedural issues, and they never come to trial. But I don't know how many years ago this was, somewhere in the COVID area, Montana, the group Our Children's Trust, that these are the kids who are suing governments, state, national governments over global warming.
When that was happening. And just a fair warning, we're into like the last, say, minute here, so sorry. Pressure.
So that was, okay, well, a trial, and the state lost. So, you know, what does that even mean? Okay. But you know, they had a prophetic case, and the state's defense was even more pathetic, you know, and it was just a whole nonsensical thing that took up a whole lot of time. And I haven't followed up to see what the state is expected to do about losing that case. It was about coal. You know, they mine a lot of coal and burn a lot of coal, and a lot of that is owned by the indigenous tribes. That's where they get their income from. So, you know, it was a case that didn't make sense, but it ended up going to court. But there's no shortage of crazies who are trying to sue and, you know, influence policy that way or make money or do whatever. So that'll keep,
well, as long as it's
like
lucrative, it'll keep going.
Yeah.
You know, when they don't get paid for it, that'll all go away. Well,
right,
I'm sorry
right,
we have to run off, and we promise not to ditch you for two more years. We will touch base. And her book is Climate Uncertainty and Risk, Rethinking Our Response. We kind of forgot to do that, too. Our guest has been Dr. Judith Curry, and we really appreciate her expert info. We'll talk to her again soon. Good luck with your fire in Reno. Hope it's gone
soon.
Thanks,
Karen. Always a pleasure to talk with you.
All right, we're coming back with Gregory Wrightstone.
Thanks for coming on.
More climate stuff.
From the smoke of a distant fire.